This is VOA News via remote. I'm Joe Palka. A Somali regional governor has survived an assassination attempt today after a suicide bomber attacked a restaurant in the town of Baidoa in the southwestern Bay region. Witnesses and officials said a man wearing a suicide vest tried to approach the governor of the Bay region, Ali Wardhir Duyo, but a security guard blocked his way. The bomber detonated the explosive vest, killing three civilians and the bodyguard. A witness at the scene told VOA Somalia the governor arrived at the restaurant minutes before the explosion. A security official who requested not to be named told VOA Somalia that the governor's bodyguards were on alert because the governor had been told recently he was the target of an assassination plot. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani oversaw on live television today the launch of advanced centrifuges to enrich uranium, a key component for nuclear weapons, while reiterating his country's commitment to nuclear non-proliferation. Now, Rouhani's conflicting messages came as the country observed National Nuclear Technology Day, during which he was seen on state television ordering the injection of uranium gas into nearly 200 centrifuges and tests on other devices at an underground nuclear plant. The U.S. and Iran have agreed to a second round of indirect talks in Vienna next week to try to bring each back into compliance with the deal, but Iran insisted that all U.S. sanctions against it be lifted, and the U.S. warned that such a demand may lead to an impasse. Gun salutes across the UK marked the death of Britain's Prince Philip on Saturday as military leaders honored the former naval officer and husband of Queen Elizabeth II. Batteries of cannons in London, Edinburgh, Cardiff, Belfast, and other cities fired 41 rounds. This is VOA News. Myanmar security forces killed more than 80 anti-junta demonstrators Thursday and Friday, according to reporting today, as activists demanding the restoration of the ousted civilian government again took to the streets in the southeast of the country. Myanmar Now News, witnesses, and the Assistance Association for Political Prisoners said the killings occurred when the government troops fired grenades at protests in the city of Bago, about 65 kilometers northeast of Yangon, which is Myanmar's largest city. Myanmar Now reported 82 people were killed, while the AAPP, a local monitoring group that tallies deaths in the country, reported that over 80 anti-coup protesters were killed by security forces in Bago on Friday. Analysts say Russia is increasing arms sales to Myanmar and to its military and steadfastly standing on Myanmar's coup leader, General Min Aung Hlaing, an alliance they say will further Moscow's foreign policy ambitions across Southeast Asia through future weapons sales. Meanwhile, leaders of at least 10 of the ethnic rebel groups have declared their support for the country's anti-coup movement. Kremlin said Friday it fears a resumption of full-scale fighting in eastern Ukraine and could take steps to protect Russian civilians there, a stark warning that comes amid a Russian troop buildup along the border. Vaccine skepticism runs deep among white evangelicals. AP correspondent Walter Ratliff has this report.
Photo posted online of the president of America's largest evangelical denomination, the Southern Baptist Convention, getting a COVID-19 vaccine drew more than 1,100 comments. Many voiced admiration for the Reverend J.D. Greer, but many others assailed him. The divided reaction highlighted a phenomenon that's become increasingly apparent in recent surveys. Vaccine skepticism is more widespread among white evangelicals than almost any other bloc of Americans. The findings have aroused concern even within evangelical circles. The National Association of Evangelicals is part of a new coalition that will work with media outlets and distribute public messages to build trust. I'm Walter Ratliff.
And U.S. rapper and actor Earl Simmons, known by the stage name DMX or Darkman X, died yesterday, People magazine said, after suffering a heart attack during what media reports said was a drug overdose. He was 50 years of age. His family had said that DMX collapsed at home and was taken to a New York hospital where his former manager said he'd been placed on life support with no brain activity. Via remote, I'm Joe Palka. This is VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
A large national opinion is saying that no matter what the result of the elections is already known, because Mr. Deby is in power for 31 years now and he is not going to leave power.
Civil society groups are calling for the postponement of Sunday's presidential election in Chad.
This election is only Patrice Talon's jubilation day. We know it. Not for our democracy. Many sovereignty is at loss. This is very bad and sad situation for our poor Benin that we all love.
Beninese go to the polls to choose a new president Sunday.
The only available option that she has, other than the undoing the Magufuli legacy, is to continue that legacy. And I simply cannot see her taking that route, because it is a dead end.
And a former presidential candidate of the Tanzanian main opposition party, Chadema, demands an investigation into the assassination attempt on his life in 2017. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Chad, civil society groups are calling for the postponement of Sunday's presidential election. They contend that ongoing human rights violations, heavy deployment of the military, and the arrest of leaders of opposition and civil society groups will undermine the integrity of the poll. Incumbent President Idriss Deby, who has been in power since 1990, is seeking a sixth term. Analysts say his defeat is highly unlikely due to what they say is his firm grip on state institutions, including the military. They also say opponent and civil society leaders, seen as a threat to his re-election bid, have been arrested on politically motivated charges. But supporters of the ruling Patriotic Salvation Movement say the criticisms are unjustified. They also dismiss as unpatriotic the calls by civil society groups for international pressure to force the postponement of Sunday's presidential poll. Delphine Kamnelon Jiraibe is a lawyer and human and civil rights defender. She tells me that conditions on the ground are not conducive to a fair and transparent election.
Civil society organizations are asking for the postponement of the presidential elections because nothing is ready for elections. Nobody is ready for elections. Conditions are not in place. There are widespread human rights violations that are ongoing. Civil society organizations cannot express themselves freely. Any demonstration, any mobilization from civil society groups are forbidden. And the same for opposition parties.
So do you think the government or perhaps the Electoral Commission adhere or listen to your calls for the postponement of the election?
Mr. Idriss Deby is using armed forces to repress any dissenting voice from civil society or from political opposition parties. Recently, one of the potential candidates, Mr. Djeru, his home was attacked, and his mother and some of his relatives were killed by armed forces. And Mr. Deby is the one that cannot hesitate to arrest his opponent to make them disappear. So the question on the table now is how we can deal with a president of a country who cannot hesitate to arrest, make disappear, and kill his opponent. And that's why we as civil society, we think that no election could take place. We need change. We need positive change, and we are asking for these elections to be postponed so that we can have proper elections. And Chadian citizens also deserve like a proper elections.
But Delphine, some supporters of the government are saying that opposition candidates who are challenging President Deby in the presidential election are going around campaigning without any problem, and that those who were affected tried to bring instability, tried to cause confusion, and that is why the security operatives dealt with them. How do you respond to that?
First of all, there is no opposition political party leader in these presidential elections. Those who are in the list are all allies for President Deby. As such, they are just accompanying him to legitimize his re-election. Persistent rumors are saying that President Deby paid them off to be candidate. Main opposition leaders are calling for an active boycott. Secondly, nothing is at stake about campaign, but what is going on is that only the ruling party is using public money and public means, including government members and civil servants, for campaigning. Any other demonstration from opposition leaders and civil society organizations is forbidden and repressed by the security forces. Even Hama. Hama is a public institution in charge of the regulation of media. They have stated that only the ruling party is visible on media, and this is an official statement. The way the security forces are acting does not leave a room for dissent voices.
Well, Delphine, I understand opposition groups are calling on Chadians not to go to the polls on Sunday to vote. But do you think they will listen to the opposition groups so that they will not go to the polls to vote? Because it appears all is set for the election on Sunday.
For sure, the calling for boycott will be followed throughout the country, as political parties who calling for boycott are popular in their various parts of the country, considered as their electoral base. Furthermore, average people who are the majority of the population does not feel concerned by the vote because they know that it will not change anything in their daily life. A large national opinion is saying that no matter what the result of the elections is already known, because Mr. Deby is in power for 31 years now and he is not going to leave power.
Delphine Kemnulum Jiraibe is a lawyer and human and civil rights defender. She spoke with me from the Chadian capital in N'Djamena. In Benin, civil society groups are condemning as a charade the presidential election on Sunday. The groups say the election is unlikely to be transparent or credible. Incumbent President Patrice Talon is seeking a second term, but opposition groups say he is using state institutions, including the police and the judiciary, to arrest and prosecute opponents on trumped-up charges. The move, they argue, is meant to disqualify any potential challenge to his re-election bid. But supporters of the president say the criticism reflects the desperation of parties whose own candidates have failed to qualify for the vote. They are calling on citizens to go to the polls on Sunday to perform their civic duty and re-elect President Talon. Gary Asaka is the spokesperson for Moms of Benin, a civil society group. She tells me the presidential election on Sunday will further erode the country's hard-earned reputation as a bastion of democracy in West Africa.
As a civil society organization, we believe that these elections are illegal because they do not respect any democratic or constitutional rule.
Well, Garia, why do you say that? Because it appears everything is set for Sunday's election. President Talon is seeking re-election. He has two or more who are challenging to defeat him. And Beninese are ready to go to the polls to choose the next president. Why are you making such statements?
Let's be honest. Everybody right now in Benin knows that those are chosen challengers by Patrice Talon himself for Sunday election. And it is so sad that we come to that level of democracy parody in Benin. It is just set up. This Sunday election is a third comedy show under Patrice Talon election rules. And he know it himself. He know it. It's so sad. It's not good for all. Not good for our democracy.
So, Gary, are you therefore saying that the presidential election on Sunday will not be transparent or credible?
No such of words. This election is only Patrice Talon Jubilation Day. We know it. Not for our democracy. Many sovereignty is at loss. This is very bad and sad situation for our poor Benin that we all love.
Gary Asaka is the spokesperson for Moms of Benin, a civil society group. She spoke with me from the capital, Cotonou. The International Society for Civil Liberties and Rule of Law, or InterSociety, a civil society group, is calling on the International Criminal Court to help prevent Nigeria from imploding. The group is calling on the new leadership of the Hague-based court to investigate what it says are gross human rights abuses, kidnappings, and alleged killings carried out by the military. It says the country is at a crossroads, with the administration appearing not to have answers to escalating insecurity in the country. This after the group petitioned the international community to pressure the government to stop what it says are killings targeting segments of the population in the country's southern state. But supporters of the ruling party reject the criticism. They cite ongoing government efforts to combat extremist violence. They also say the administration has demonstrated its commitment to defeating Boko Haram militants, who they say carry out attacks against civilians in parts of the country's north. To learn more about the calls for the ICC inquiry, I reach Emeka Omiagbalasi, head of InterSociety in the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
We are the International Society for Civil Liberties and Rule of Law. Today issued a statement calling on the newly elected presidency of the International Criminal Court and the chief prosecutor of the court to ensure that Nigeria is not allowed to explode and implode. And we said that because having Israel the circumstances that led to the election, the caliber of people elected, we believe that it is time to identify with them and heartily congratulate them, and at the same time directing the attention to what is going on in Nigeria. The truth of the matter is that Nigeria is at crossroads of uncertainties. The fact remains that the country is in a state of war against itself.
But Emeka, supporters of the government have dismissed calls by your group, including other opposition groups, for an independent investigation by the ICC about the growing insecurity in the country. They said this is a problem for many countries across Africa and the world, and that terrorism is being combated by government. And that is what the administration currently is doing in Nigeria. How do you respond to that?
What is going on in Nigeria is not a peculiar situation. Besides, the ICC statute does not have any provision for exemption of this kind of goings-on in Nigeria, this kind of troubles Nigeria is undergoing. In the ICC statute, the crimes are clearly defined. Their perpetrators are also clearly defined and they categorize into state actor and non-state actor perpetrators. So the position of government of Nigeria is outrightly dismissive. Such position can never be taken serious by people of conscience and people who have integrity and people who know their onions locally and internationally. The truth of the matter is that the Nigerian government is complicit in what is going on in Nigeria. Simpliciter. So that's whatever excuse the government is giving is null and void.
Well, Emeka,
Critics of your organization are saying that by calling on the international court to investigate some of these issues that you're bringing up, it's basically calling for an international interference in Nigeria's internal political situation, and that Nigeria is capable of handling some of these things, and that is exactly what the government is doing. How do you react to that?
So, as a third party to ICC, there is nothing like interference in the internal affairs of Nigeria. Secondly, and very importantly, under the ICC charter, there is principle, existing principle called principle of complementarity and zero impunity. That principle allows the ICC, a member state of ICC, to address the alleged crimes whenever it is alleged that crimes has been committed, international crimes have been committed, or about are suspected to have been committed. So that principle allows that government to address the issue.
Emeka, some people are criticizing your group for not being forceful enough regarding what they said are growing insecurity in parts of the southern part of the country. How do you react to that?
Inter-society has never changed. We are raising a strong condemnation of all forms of violence, whether perpetrated by state actors or non-state actors. But what the truth of the matter is that what is playing out in Nigeria today was caused remotely and in the open by the same government of Nigeria. When you push people to the war, nothing, you can never determine what will happen. Look at the recent case where over 550 innocent and defenseless Igbos were abducted by Nigerian army and bundled to secret detentions in northern Nigeria, where they were detained for 4 to 5 months, outside for official record, outside public knowledge, including 60 women, about 60 women among them, many of whom were raped by same soldiers. Until today, Nigerian government has not said anything.
Emeka Omiagbalasi is the head of Inter Society, a Nigerian civil society group. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. In Uganda, the Opposition National Unity Platform, or NUP, is accusing President Yoweri Museveni and his government of persecution. This after Robert Kyagulanyi, also known as Bobi Wine, presented his bulletproof car to the authorities for a tax re-evaluation. A driver of the opposition leader drove the car to the Ugandan Revenue Authority for the re-evaluation Friday. In a statement, the Ugandan Revenue Authority says it had undervalued the car because it did not know the vehicle was bulletproof. But supporters of the NUP rejected the statement, calling it yet another attempt by the authorities to use state institutions to harass and persecute opponents of the administration. Parliamentarian Joel Senyonyi is spokesperson for the NUP. He says the statement by the Revenue Authority claiming to have undervalued the car was disappointing. He tells me that the authorities demanded the re-evaluation of the car only because Bobi Wine purchased it from another Ugandan who had already paid all the required fees.
The quick history of this car is that the election turned out to be like a military operation. You know, there's a journalist that was always by his side. They shot him in the head. He's recovering, you know. His music partner, Nubian Lee, was also hit by a tear gas canister. He was seated next to Bobi Wine. Another time, they nearly shot Honorable Zake, who was also next to Bobi Wine. So after people kept seeing Ugandans, especially both Ugandans and those in the diaspora, decided that let's find ways of securing a presidential candidate. So they bought him bulletproof jackets, which he kept wearing, and a bulletproof helmet. And also, they raised money and bought him a bulletproof car for his safety. So this car was bought through somebody else's names, and so it would be as if Bobi Wine is buying it from this person. So the car was cleared as bulletproof. It was taken to police, cleared. The revenue authorities cleared it, and the taxes that were meant to be paid were paid. So after that, the car was eventually transferred into Bobi Wine's name. So now when Museveni heard that this car belongs to Bobi Wine, he was furious, said, how was this thing cleared? And so he ordered that it should be taken away and reevaluated. It's obviously a question of persecution. But he'll say that the law-abiding citizen, if they say they want to reevaluate it, that's okay. And so one of his drivers took the car to the revenue authorities today to say, okay, you want to reevaluate it and tell us what's really you are trying to say. But the long and short, like I'm saying, it's persecution.
Some supporters of the NRM are saying that it is not true that Bobi Wine is politically being persecuted, and that if a mistake was made initially and the car was not appropriately evaluated, sending it back for re-evaluation shouldn't cause a political uproar as it is causing now. How do you react to that?
Well, you talk about a mistake. So do they realize there was a mistake when it is Bobi Wine? Because you see, here in Uganda, a couple of people actually have bulletproof cars, you know, business people and other folks who feel their lives are threatened and they can afford to acquire a bulletproof car. And they are cleared. You clear not just the revenue authorities, but with police as well, Interpol. And it was the same situation with this car. It's just that it was in somebody else's names at the time. And so it was taken to Interpol, it was taken to the revenue authorities, they evaluated and gave a tax to be paid, and that tax was paid. So now that it is in Bobi Wine's name, is that when they say, ah, there must have been a mistake? It is obvious, Peter. If it looks like a dog, walks like a dog, barks like a dog, it is a dog.
But, Joel, the Uganda Revenue Authority said that it undervalued the vehicle because it did not know it was bulletproof, and that is why this has to be corrected. Why do you think that is not true?
If it is true that they have said that they undervalued because they didn't know it was bulletproof, then they're making fools of themselves. Even a child can tell that this is a bulletproof car, you know, because they had the car with it, they frisked it, they checked it and so on. It was taken to Interpol and it was assessed by police officers. So if you tell me that police officers can check a car, open doors, check everywhere, and they don't realize that it is bulletproof, then they are making fools of themselves, I think.
What does the party intend to do now that officially the car has been taken to the Uganda Revenue Authority to be re-evaluated?
Well, the owner of the car, Bobi Wine, has made it very clear. He's law-abiding, and so that's why he sent the car himself. They didn't even have to come and impound it. He said, look, I'm law-abiding, so if you think that there is an issue you want to re-evaluate, here is the car. So let's wait and see what they say, because the car was evaluated and taxes paid. So let's see what they say.
Well, some people are suggesting that the way the process by which Bobi Wine acquired the car is fishy in itself. And this is the reason why the NUP is making noise about this re-evaluation. And that if he had done it himself, he wouldn't be facing such re-evaluation, they argue. What's your response to that?
I mean, if you... This is laughable. I don't know how cars are acquired in your country, but you see, in my country, I can buy a car anytime from anybody. You know, so somebody can import a car and I can buy it from them, transfer it into my name. Now, taxes were already paid by this person, so I don't have to pay taxes again just because it is Joel Senyonyi or Bobi Wine now acquiring this car or changing the names and so on. But for me, the long and short is, because those who are saying that he acquired it in fishy ways, but it was taken to police, Interpol, international police, and evaluated, was taken to the revenue authorities and evaluated. So which fishy ways are they talking about?
Parliamentarian Joel Senyonyi is the spokesperson for the Ugandan opposition NUP. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala.
Relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music, and Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.
Stay informed and up to date Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 1705 UTC with VOA's International Edition. Our correspondents bring you the news from around the globe, plus we delve into the context of the day's biggest stories with interviews with experts that place the story into context to understand why it matters. VOA's International Edition, your best source for news and information.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, Tundu Lissu, a former presidential candidate of the Tanzanian main opposition party, Chadema, is calling on President Samia Suluhu Hassan to demand an investigation into the assassination attempt on his life in 2017. Then Vice President Hassan visited him while he received medical attention in neighboring Kenya following the attack. Yet to be identified assailant, shot Lissu several times at the capital, Dodoma. His party blames the government for the attempt on his life, an accusation supporters of the government deny. They cite recent statement by the police that investigations are still ongoing to determine those responsible for the attack. Meanwhile, Lissu also says newly installed President Hassan has the power to give Tanzanians what he says is the foundation of democracy. He tells me that the president has a constitutional duty to protect Tanzanians. This, Lissu says, is the key reason why the president must demand an inquiry to ensure those responsible for the assassination attempt are punished by the full force of the law.
On September 7 of 2017, I survived a gun attack outside my residence in the parliamentary capital of Dodoma, in which I was shot 16 times. The attack came 2 hours after the then President John Pombe Magufuli had said that the enemies of his policies did not deserve to live. And 2 hours later, I was shot and nearly killed. That attack has never been investigated. I have never been questioned about the attack. The government has never arrested anybody. In fact, it has always said that it did not even have a suspect. And now that we have a new president and she has called for reconciliation, it is time for her and her government to come clean on this attack because there cannot be any reconciliation if these things are not cleared up. I live in exile immediately after last year's elections. Death threats started being made again, and I was forced to flee. And therefore, it is only fair to ask the new president to tell me and to tell the Tanzanian people who tried to kill me nearly 4 years ago.
Well, Mr. Lissu, some people are suggesting that it's too soon for the president to delve into this because she was just installed as the new president. There are a lot of issues she's tackling now, including the coronavirus pandemic now, and that it should give her a little time to look into some of these issues. What do you think about it?
Number one, how long does she need to ask her security forces, to ask the Tanzania Intelligence and Security Service, to ask the police force to inform her on what really happened? How long does she need to tell us that? She's not going to do the investigation herself personally. She was part of that government, by the way.
Some people are suggesting that she came to visit you while you were in hospital and that you should trust her to look into what you are saying, and that a little time perhaps would be nice for her to come to speed with some of these issues.
I understand that, and I have always publicly appreciated the fact that she's the only government and ruling party leader who came to visit me in hospital in Nairobi. Only one. But to come back to your question, she has not made a single statement since she became president about the attack, about the threats on my life when I returned last year, about the fact that I was forced out of the country because of death threats. I will not be saying this if she had made a public statement or even a private statement to tell me that she's going to look into this and that she needs time. As it is, she hasn't made any statement, private or public. In fact, I reached out to her immediately after she was sworn in. I took the effort to contact her personal assistant. I asked them to relay a message to her that I would like to speak to her about, you know, the way forward for our country.
A lot of people are praising her for saying that the media will be granted more freedoms and she will engage with civil society and opposition groups. Some people are praising her effort at opening the political space for some of you to operate freely. What do you think about this gesture she's made since she was installed as the new president?
Let's get the facts right. Of all the things that you have mentioned, the only one that is correct is with regard to restrictions on media. And even on media, she has said the ban on online TV that were critical of the Magufuli government should be lifted. She and her own people in the government have said publicly that the lifting of the ban does not relate to newspapers which were shut down by President Magufuli. She hasn't said anything about the journalists who were persecuted, about Azory Gwanda, the journalist who was abducted in 2017 and has gone missing ever since. She has not said anything about the draconian laws which impinge on free speech and freedom of the press that were enacted in the past 5 years will be revisited.
What are your expectations of this new administration?
I am very optimistic that she will change a lot of things. She will undo some of the toxic legacy of her predecessor. And I say this not naively. I'm not naive about the difficulties of her doing this. But I believe she will change because she doesn't have any other option. The only available option that she has, other than undoing the Magufuli legacy, is to continue that legacy. And I simply cannot see her taking that route because it is a dead end.
Tundu Lissu is a former presidential candidate of the Tanzanian main opposition party, Chadema. He spoke with me from Brussels, Belgium. The UN's World Food Programme says it has been forced to further reduce rations for refugees and displaced people in South Sudan because of a lack of funding. It says 700,000 people this month will see food rations drop to just half the recommended daily amount. For VOA, Winnie Sirino reports from the South Sudanese capital, Juba.
Matthew Hollingworth, country director of the World Food Programme, or WFP, in South Sudan, said the decision for WFP to reduce its food rations is a painful one but necessary because the organisation has not received enough contributions. He said South Sudan was already in a dire situation even before the WFP decided to implement these cuts.
With the worsening food insecurity this year, where we expect around 7.2 million people to suffer from severe acute food insecurity in this lean season coming, we have to prioritise the most needy, knowing that those who will lose some of their assistance will suffer because of the decision.
He says the 700,000 people affected will now get 50% of a normal daily ration, down from the 70% they received before. Hollingworth said he understands that people who struggle to meet their basic needs cope by skipping or reducing meals, taking out loans, selling assets, or by sending the children out to work, which can increase domestic violence because they are in desperate situations. He said the WFP will keep monitoring the situation.
We will be working with the communities themselves and with organizations that support them in the camps to monitor the situation, to try and ensure we can mitigate the impact on the most vulnerable. For example, because we know these sorts of cuts can lead to higher rates of malnutrition and anemia, WFP will make sure that young mothers and their babies from these communities will continue to receive our nutrition support despite the other ration cuts.
He said to continue to provide sufficient food quantities, including larger rations, WFP needs more funding.
The World Food Programme in South Sudan immediately needs some $125 million for our assistant operations just for the next 6 months. We're calling on our partners, donor governments, and wealthy individuals around the world to step up and support the people of the world's newest nation so that we can prevent starvation, we can sustain our food assistance programmes to vulnerable refugees and the displaced, and we can reinstate the rations we've had to cut as soon as possible.
Hollingworth called on the government of South Sudan to provide more agricultural land so that refugees and IDPs living in the camps can grow their own produce, and for South Sudanese who have a surplus to help those in need. Peter Mayen, South Sudan's Minister for Humanitarian Assistance, said the COVID-19 pandemic has stretched donors' resources and made it harder to raise funds for food aid. Mayen appealed to international donors to make contributions so lives can be saved. Winnie Serino for VOA News, Juba.
The fate of hundreds of thousands of refugees in Kenya hangs in the balance as UN officials try to dissuade Kenyan authorities from closing two camps that many have called home for the past 3 decades. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The Kenyan government announced its intention to close the Dadaab and Kakuma refugee camps on March 24th. It gave the UN Refugee Agency 2 weeks to come up with a roadmap for returning home the 430,000 residents of the two sprawling camps. Most come from Somalia. That deadline was up Thursday. However, the refugees and the UNHCR have been given a last-minute reprieve. News organizations and activists report Kenya's High Court on Thursday suspended the government's closure order for 30 days. UNHCR spokesman Baba Baluch says his agency is deeply concerned about the impact Kenya's closure of the camps would have on the needs of the refugees, including their need for protection from the COVID-19 pandemic.
We are in constant dialogue with the authorities on the issue and have been urging them to ensure that any decisions allow for suitable and sustainable solutions to be found, and that those who continue to need protection as refugees are able to receive it in line with Kenya's national and international obligations.
Baluch says a statement issued by the UNHCR's office in Nairobi recognizes the generosity extended by the people and government of Kenya towards the refugees for many decades.
The statement says that UNHCR has shared with the government of Kenya a proposed set of sustainable and right-based measures aimed at identifying solutions for refugees living in the Dadaab and Kakuma refugee camps. We have heard the concerns expressed by the government of Kenya and hope that these measures will be a significant step forward in accelerating, as I mentioned, sustainable solutions for all those concerned.
The UNHCR's plan includes a provision for increasing the voluntary repatriation of refugees, taking into account restrictions imposed because of COVID-19. It proposes that some refugees from East Africa be allowed to remain in Kenya and become self-reliant and contributing members of society. The plan also calls for the resettlement to third countries of refugees who would run life-threatening risks were they to be returned to their countries of origin. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
She told my love that love. She talks out the book. She won't know the cook. But I want to give you some love. She talks out the coco. She still want know the coco. Yeah. If money no day, now wait till she get. She tell me say she gonna run away. She gonna run any better way. Yeah. I said rubber don't day, the baby come the bell. See the baby don't come again. You don't forget back in a day. I've been there beg you to try. If I don't get today, I go get them tomorrow. I be you one make a die. Be no easy for me. If I don't get today, I go get them tomorrow. Say one for the money. Two for the dough. Three for the shorty. Now I don't blow. One for the money. Two for the dough.
me no care, me no tender. You rejected my love cause I was broke. I've been the enter of the high. From me to my time, straight to another hill. How are we? Say, you believe me. Back then, if I was die, those days in Junior Abuja. You insist, hey, you don't need me. Can I try everything to spend my life with you? Yeah, I've been there, beg you to try. Reason with me. If I don't get today, I go get that tomorrow. I be you one make a die. If I don't get today, I go get them tomorrow. Say one for the money, two for the dough, three for the shorty, now I don't blow. One for the money, two for the dough, three for the shorty, now I don't blow. Say one for the money, two for the dough, three for the shorty, now I don't blow. One for the money, two for the dough, three for the shorty, now I don't blow. If money no day, now wait till she get up. Now so she say she gonna run away. She gonna run very bad away. Yeah. As the rubber don't day, the baby come the bell. See the baby don't come again. You don't forget back in a days. I've been there beg you to try. Reason with me. If I don't get today, I go get that tomorrow. I be you one make a die. It's not easy for me. If I don't get today, go get them tomorrow. I've been there begging to try. Reason with me. If I don't get today, I go get them tomorrow. I'll be you one make a die. It's not easy for me. If I don't get today, I go get them tomorrow. Say one for the money, two for the dough, three for the shorty. Now I don't blow. One for the money.
Norman Bons, l'ambassadeur de Carnot. Aristide Angouré, mon colo.
Good to die, good to die, good to die.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, Managing Editor Bill Eagle, Reporter Douglas Impuga, and Producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, if you are a flag, follow the wind. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.